Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of sensitive topics such as suicide.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Turning Tides podcast. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. Kay Young is an author, musician, and multimedia creator. He's currently in the process of writing his magnum opus, Mystics, a massive work of fiction which is largely based in the mythologies from cultures from across the planet. He has the first part of it out now, with more releases to follow. Kay, first of all, happy No King's Day, and how are you doing?
Doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm hanging in there, trying to survive in this crazy rat race. But I'm really glad that I'm really glad that you're on the show. You've written a really fantastic piece of literature here, and I'd like to just give you the moment or a few minutes here to just tell us about Mystics, tell us about the plot, the characters. And what exactly inspired you to write it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, like you had said, it's the first part is out now. You can actually read that on webnovel.com. It's called Mystics Prototype, The Book of Merlin, Volume 1. And I must preface before you guys go and read, I go by the moniker dyslexic author. I stay true to that. When I initially wrote the Book of Merlin, it was my very first book that I ever attempted to write. And it's very clear once you do read it that this is a first book, but essentially, I'm not ashamed of my dyslexia. As a matter of fact, I use that as fuel to make my writing better. But a little bit about the plot, characters, and inspiration. So the story for the Book of Merlin, I should preface, the story follows the titular character Merlin as he's reincarnated into another mystical realm, right? So he's originally from Earth, and he's reincarnated in this new world. In this new world, it's not populated by humans, so to speak. Every person of this realm is of some sort of monster heritage, whether it be dragons, fairies, demons, what have you. They're all some sort of fantasy creature. So he finds himself in this world of monsters that is of complete peace, and he has to basically navigate this new environment, as well as going to school and understanding, you know, how he fits into this world. The first book, I believe I published it back in like 2023, and it was about like 170 odd pages, 150 pages or so. And I had sat on that for like, I want to say a solid year and a half before I started writing the second installment, which is the current part that I'm publishing on web novel now, which is Mystics Prototype, The Book of Minerva, which follows Merlin's younger sister, Minerva, and with similar plot beats, being reincarnated into the same world. However, the story does lend itself to be something very different with a female lead character, as well as just the different struggles that she would need to go through. I'm really hoping that it turns out, turns out really, really well. As a second installment, I know second installments and like trilogies and stuff don't really do well, but I'm thinking this one is going to do pretty good.
Well, that sounds very, very interesting. And I just wanted to ask a quick follow-up. But do all these does the first book, the Book of Merlin and the Book of Minerva, they take place in the modern day, or do they take place in some sort of ethereal realm, or how does that work?
So it takes place of the timeline is kind of sort of all over the place,
I
but
asked the
the
big
best way I
question,
can
huh?
describe it right, a really big question, but it's a fun question because I love to answer this. So the realm is located within the Earth, like kind of like think of the inner Earth theory, but not really inner Earth. So it's not like you have to dig down into like the crust or the mantle or whatever. It's like a realm that is it's inside of the Earth, but accessing it isn't by going inside. It's complicated, but to say this to say to try to simplify it, it takes place throughout like the beginning of like the Big Bang to really like the end of the universe. It spans the entirety of that time period, and I try to like match up the time period for the realm because it does move at a much slower rate. In the fantasy realm that the characters are in, it moves a lot slower than Earth's time. And I try to like match things up. So, for example, slight little spoiler for the Book of Minerva, there's a character who is revealed to be a spy, right? And he infiltrates this realm and he tells our characters that he's not from, the realm that he's in right now, and that he's from a place that was once called Rodinia but is now called Pangaea. If you know anything about supercontinents, before Pangaea there was a continent called Rodinia. So if you see like I'm trying to like line things up to where it makes sense like thematically and narrative wise, because my third book in the trilogy is meant to be taking place during like the Mesopotamian War, and like Greek, like the well, not Greek, but more like Mycenaean Wars and things like that. So I try to line everything up as much as best as I can. It's a little difficult, but I'm doing my best.
It sounds like a real monumental task you've laid out for yourself. And I think a lot of the stuff you just said is going to bleed over into my next question here. So what first got you interested in mythology, and how did you even start to put all these elements into an original work like this that, as you've just been saying, is incredibly expansive?
So, and I also really love this question too. So, my creative lore is very interesting. I've been a creative my entire life, since I came out the womb. I've been reciting Bone Thugs and Harmony lyrics since before I can talk. Like, I'm super, super creative. When I was, I want to say, I think like in the second or third grade, I think it was the second grade, I used to watch this show on HBO Family called Happily Ever After: Fairy Tales for Every Child. It was this amazing, amazing animated work that told stories like Thumbelina, The Princess and the Frog, all of those different like fairy tales that we grew up with, but it told it in a new light. So it was with like a different culture as the backdrop, but still the same story. One story in particular from this show I remember that it stuck with me for my entire life was a story about a Ghanaian trickster deity by the name of Anansi. And Anansi is a spider. I used to be so afraid of spiders for like zero reason, but because I would
I'm
always
still
find
afraid of
like, well,
spiders.
there was a reason. I would always yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, spiders are they can be a little creepy, but they're cute. But I have a strong love for spiders because of Anansi. And Anansi, as a trickster deity, has one trait about him that never goes away, and that's the fact that he's a storyteller. And since I was a kid, I've always resonated with him and his stories that he would tell. So in this particular episode of Happily Ever After, Anansi was tasked to basically he was basically tasked to like spin some gold. It was the story of Rumpelstiltskin, right? And instead of Rumpelstiltskin being the character, it was Anansi. And Anansi went around and he was tricking a bunch of people into thinking that he could do all these things, but it was the sheer confidence that he had lying to all of these villagers that really was like, and the fact that he had them believe him was something that I was like, wow, I can see as to why he is who he is in like Ghanaian mythology. So
What culture was Anansi a part of? I'm
I
sorry.
really owe Ghanaian
Ghanaian, okay.
from Ghana.
Ghana. Very interesting.
I really cherish I really cherish Anansi as a whole, for that, as well as like other like notable like storytellers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story of the Arabian Nights, which is one of the 1,000 tales of Scheherazade.
I've heard of
Scheherazade was
Scheherazade,
his
yeah.
concubine. Yeah, so you would know that she was the concubine of a sultan who killed every single storyteller that could not make him fall asleep. And she just so happened to trick him by giving him a fuck ton of cliffhangers. And he was so enthralled by her that he refused to kill her because he wanted to know what happened next. And that is something else that stuck with me as well too, because I feel like that level of suspense is definitely needed when it comes down to telling stories. I find the most gripping books to be ones shrouded in suspense.
Is that how you first go into incorporating it? Is through the suspense and what's the best way to leave people hanging on for the next one?
Yeah, in a way, so like I'll like compose like a scene in my head, and leading up to said scene, I will leave little breadcrumbs of like mystery and suspense and whatnot. Really trying to set the atmosphere. I feel like that is super important, especially when it comes down to writing like mysteries and thrillers and whatnot. They're not saying that this is a mystery or a thriller. It does lean in that direction, but because it's an epic, you got to have literally every genre in the book to write an epic. And it's one of those things that I found it to be a lot easier now, that I've been writing this for shit, I think 6 years. I think 2019 is when I started writing
I
the
believe so,
story.
yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 29, like December 2019 when I started writing the story. And literally the past 6.5 years of developing it, I've understood how to create that atmosphere and how to give the reader just enough to where they are satisfied. And that's something that I can confidently say about the Book of Merlin, the first installment. It it did that too much. Like every chapter was a cliffhanger. And I didn't really start to mature as a writer until like towards the end of that particular book. And then of course reading my stories, you'll be able to see like he's grown, he's come a long way since that hot dyslexic mess of a first book.
Yeah, you should never judge anyone based on their first piece of writing or art or whatever. I mean, if you were to listen to the first episode of the Turning Tides podcast, it would be nowhere near the same level as it is right now. And it's because, like with anything else, it takes time, and it's a process of throwing it up against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Right, definitely. And that's something else too, because I recently saw this like video on TikTok, and this girl basically, or this young woman, I should say, she basically was stating that it is okay for you to be a bad artist, to allow yourself to be a bad artist, because it gives you the opportunity to be an artist. And I just found that so prophetic and profound that, I really like, it made me appreciate my very first book that much more, because I know that people say like, oh, I'm gonna write a book, I wanna do this, I wanna do that. But until you actually take the time and push through it and actually complete it, then you can then say, yeah, I did this, I wrote this. And that was one of the things that I kept telling myself, that I had to finish this. I had to finish this book. I had to, because if I don't, then it's going to be gone forever. And I don't want this story to be gone forever. This is too gripping of a story for the world not to see. And ultimately, I understood that, like, I do have to, go back, and I have to revise and edit that first book, but I'm still not like, I'm not ashamed of it anymore. I'm not scared of people reading it and then critiquing it or judging me, because I go in the book, I'll go from like first person to like third person out of random. And it's because, like the way my brain works is kind of like, oh, I see what's going on here. Like, kind of just forgetting that, But ultimately, again, I just feel like giving yourself that time to be a bad artist is important to get to for you to get to where you are now.
Yeah, definitely. The only way a diamond is formed is through immense pressure. I mean, that's the only way it happens. It's the same thing with any artist. I mean, no one just woke up one day. I mean, maybe someone did. Maybe like Robin Williams or someone woke up one day and they were just fantastic, right? But it stands to
Well, I
reason
will
that.
say that there, although it's an outlier, that has actually happened. Quick little tangent. There was a guy on Book Talk recently who had got a three book deal, book signing deal, and he didn't write like a single like word on his manuscript. It was just an idea. So it's possible. But it's definitely not the reality for sure.
Wow. Wow, that's something. So the next question. I want to find this guy now and poke him in the eyes. No, I'm kidding.
Think I was like, I feel like he has like such a generic ass name, to be honest with you. Like it's like Levi Travis or some shit like that.
Oh my God. So anyways, of all the myths and the fables that you've researched and you've incorporated into Mystics, what are your favorites and why?
So a lot of my favorite myths that I incorporated into the story. It's a bit. So I should
You
probably
choose
start by
multiple.
listening the di listing. So There's definitely inspiration from the Epic of Gilgamesh, the quintessential story of this world. If you know anything about the Epic of Gilgamesh, it came from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest known writing, source of writing that we have in existence at the moment. And it tells the story of this king, this tyrant king who wants to live forever. He doesn't achieve it because the flower in which that is supposed to give him immortality was eaten by a snake. And so all he could do was laugh. He The story that, and that's just a grossly simplified version of the story. There's a lot more that goes into it. But the story of immortality and the desire to be immortal from King Gilgamesh, is one that I felt like I could write a way for him to achieve that and still somewhat be sort of true to today's like reality. So in a sense, I'm writing like alternate fiction, or alternate history, I should say, alternate historic fiction. And so the story of Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is definitely, I would say, the very first myth that inspired me to write mystics, mostly because the very first, like literally the very first thing of this story that I wrote included Gilgamesh, and they needed to flesh out a backstory for him. And so I did my research on the Epic of Gilgamesh, immediately fell in love with the story, and so also started to see how this story influenced all of the stories that we have today.
True.
Another one of my favorite myths that I haven't incorporated yet, but I am looking forward to incorporate, is Journey to the West. I love Wukong. Actually the whole gang, Wukong, Pigsy, Sandy, and Tripitaka.
Can you
I
tell
love
me a little bit
the
of what Journey to the West is? Because I'm not familiar with that.
you know I'd love to. So are you familiar with the Chinese monkey king Sun Wukong?
See no evil, speak no evil. Am I in the ballpark?
Kind of, sort of.
Okay.
No. So the Monkey King Sun Wukong is a very prominent figure in Buddhist mythology and the Buddhist religion because he overcomes his impulsiveness, right? So the story of Journey to the West is a it's like a parallel for the mind, right? The human body, the human being, it goes without saying that everybody tends to act on impulses, whether you want to or not. And Wukong, the Monkey King, is a representation of that. So, a very Cliff Notes summary of the story. But like thousands of years ago, this in China specifically, the Chinese heavily bureaucracy were all like keeping their eye on this like stone that was shaped as an egg. They were terrified of it because there was a like a little prophecy that said that once the stone like broke, the entire kingdom of heaven will be destroyed. Well, lo and behold, that egg-shaped rock cracked open, and inside of it was this stone monkey. And the monkey he was able to talk and move and all that other good stuff. He found a group of other monkeys, and they all communed with each other, and they ended up naming him the Monkey King after he achieved it, a great feat that nobody thought that they could pull off. So the monkey is now the stone monkey is now the king of these monkeys, and he has an existential crisis where he realizes that at some point he's going to die. So what does he do? He goes and search for a way of immortality. Love it. And he finds a monk that teaches him a very unique way of breathing. to which adds a good, I want to say, 7,500 years onto his life, something around that number.
Wow.
And he also was given the ability to transform into any creature on Earth. This also stacked more life on him because he can just easily turn into something else with a longer lifespan. So he's now doubly immortal, and he decides that he wants to go and wreak havoc in heaven. And that's exactly what he does. So you remember prior, I said all of heaven was scared that this stone was going to crack and heaven was going to be destroyed. And that came true because Wukong wrecked the place by himself, up against hundreds of thousands of Chinese gods. Like not just like regular like angels or anything, like they're like actual gods. Sun Wukong went through and completely floored, wiped the floor with them, to
Wow.
the point where Buddha had to step in, and had to pretty much correct his actions. So the Buddha basically gave Wukong a challenge and told him, if you can jump from the palm of my hand to the end of the universe, then I'll let you do, whatever you want. You can be the king of heaven. And so Wukong, he hops into the Buddha's hand. He does a somersault and ends up at the edge of the universe, and he sees five pillars. And so he's like, "Oh, sweet! I'm at the edge of the universe." And he does a little monkey graffiti and pees on one of the pillars. Jumps back onto the Buddha's hand. Is like, "I did it! I'm at the edge of the. I went to the edge of the universe. You can make me king." And the Buddha was like, "Hey, look at my hand. I want you to take a look at my hand." And in on like his middle finger, on the Buddha's middle finger, you could see where Wukong graffitied and peed on his finger. And from that point, the Buddha basically punished Wukong and put him under a rock until about 500 years later, where he has to redeem himself by going and helping a monk reach enlightenment. On his journey, he comes across many different like monsters of the week, as well as just growing as a character and as a person. He goes from this extremely impulsive monkey king to an actual Buddha. Spoiler alert for this 1,000-year-old story, but he becomes the Buddha of victorious fight. And I think that having a character that complex is in a story that is that old is a like that's like a wondrous thing, because it shows you that people were thinking about these same like topics of mental health and impulses and whatnot, even thousands of years ago. So I'm really looking forward to like incorporating the Monkey King story into my own. However, I haven't gotten there yet. So, but that's another one of my favorite myths that inspired me. And then Yasuke story and the story of Yasuke the samurai and feudal Japan and Arthurian legends as well too. Two of my stories, I should say, I have King Arthur in the story, working alongside our heroes. So,
Wow. I have you read Mark Twain, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court?
I have not actually, but it has been something that I've been wanting to.
It's such a fascinating book, and it's one of the few, 'cause Mark Twain, he's a very interesting guy. I mean, he did serve in the Confederacy, but he was sort of pressed into service. The second he had the chance, he ran away. But basically after that, he was very he came out very openly against slavery and enslavement. And King Arthur, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court is probably the most openly anti-enslavement that he was. Like, there were obviously things like Huckleberry Finn were sort of inherently anti-slavery, in my opinion. But this one,
No,
it
it really
was.
is.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. I mean, I've never like cried genuine full-on tears like that reading a book the way I did for when I read Huckleberry Finn for the first time. But anyways, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court is very interesting because he's sort of doing what you're doing right now, but instead of putting someone in his day into King Arthur's day, you're sort of taking people from King Arthur's day in the ages of Gilgamesh, and you're bringing them to a more contemporary place.
Yes, that's actually exactly the direction that I wanted to take this in. I know we had we talked about inspirations. I do have to give a couple more, just because I feel like I'll be doing the story a disservice, as well as my credits a disservice. There are a couple of anime that also inspired the story. One in particular being a low fallacy visual novel called Fate Stay Night. And basically in this story, we have characters like King Arthur, Gilgamesh, Cucullin, Hercules, all of these characters that are serving their mage master and fighting in this Holy Grail War. And the story takes place in modern day Japan. So I really have to acknowledge that it does have a lot of fate references as well too. And it's definitely something that I really like. I don't know, it resonated with me, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then that's a good segue to our next question. You mentioned, what was the name of that anime, by the way?
It's called Fate's Day Night.
Fate's Day Night. You mentioned that. Are there other, can you think of other effective fables besides the market regulating itself and trickle-down Reaganomics?
Really, like, as far as other fables and stuff goes, I really try to find, again, that's something that resonates with me. So, like, stories of liberation and revolution usually is something that I lean towards. But also, I tend to find myself going towards the, what's a good word for it? I find myself diving into, like, existentialism as well too. So like with The Epic of Gilgamesh as well as Journey to the West, those also deal with existentialism as well too. I find stories like that tend to aid in the storytelling process and in the writing process, just so you can understand the environment in which you're trying to write or cultivate. I definitely feel as though the story of course the Underground Railroad is a major like Southern myth that's still effective to this day. No matter how many people want to say Harriet Tubman didn't exist, it's still a very say that? Like, powerful. Heck yes, bro! Like, oh my literally, God. It's actually insane how many people are saying just stupid nonsense online right now, and the people that agree with them as well. And so, like, and I bring up Harriet Tubman specifically because I feel as though she's become some sort of not a folklore in American history, but more like a legend, you know what I mean? Like she's somebody who, yeah, and exactly, a symbol. And I think that it's important to understand these particular like these stories and what happened in order for you to have like that I guess that resonance with the theme. Ultimately when I'm trying to fill in the words, I'm so sorry. But I say all of that to basically say I feel like those are Those are the ones that I lean towards. I don't really lean towards,
This is maybe the most important question, I think, in the interview, this next one I'm about to ask. Why do these stories matter? I mean, the Epic of Gilgamesh is based on the oldest writing in the world, and the Monkey King is at least as old as Buddha, which is what several thousand years old. Why? What relevance do they have today to you and me?
So I'm going to use a term that I came up with for my story. It actually is something that I kind of believe within myself. But I had brought up a term earlier called ancestral resonance, right? Or resonance. I kept saying that. And that's the term that I want to use, and as far as why it's important. So I had mentioned earlier that I had connected with Scheherazade and Anansi, and because I resonated with them so much, I felt a calling that was, sorry, I felt a calling that was ancestral, that was more divine, if that makes sense. And that is one of like the driving factors that made me and pushed me to continue this story. So I like to call them my divine wills, if you will. The will of storytelling, the two wills of storytelling that I have, both from Scheherazade and Anansi, I definitely feel like if there were like some sort of like storytelling god out there, I feel called to tell said amazing story, to make said amazing epic.
It's the like the muse. You're feeling the Greek idea of the muse.
Yes, exactly. And it's actually funny that you bring that up because, and this is gonna sound a little goofy, but again, I love anime. I have a huge affinity for anime, and the Greeks had believed that they believed in a power system, like devil fruits and like haki and stuff from One Piece, similar with the Greeks, and their power system was that of the muse. Every Greek creative believed they had a muse, or in their words, a genius. That's where the word genius came from, because it's genie. But they had believed that they had this like higher spirit that was able to relay all of their like knowledge and creative like inspirations. It you that 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 ghost spirit or whatever use the physical person to relay whatever like they want to, whatever creative they want to deliver. So I believe that there's some truth behind that, mostly because stories like this just doesn't come out of nowhere, like I had mentioned before. Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien had wrote The Hobbit and the Rings, and he felt as though he was translating a story that was already being told. So it's things like that resonate with me a lot. And the resonance that I have for this story is, in my opinion, it is divine, it is ancestral, and I feel called to write it.
That's a powerful answer. And that just I mean, it speaks to something innate in I think all people. There's no culture anywhere that doesn't recount the tales of their ancestry in some grandiose, magnificent way. And I would argue the same reason people are trying to say that Harriet Tubman isn't real is for the same, because they're trying to deny that this ancestry exists, that there was this pushback and there was this solidarity with you know, with the Underground Railroad, and it just right. speaks to how important, I think, not just mythology but also historical myth making and legend making is. A lot of people say that, you know, history is written by the victors. And if Mark Bulick is listening, I'm going to steal his quote. But you know, legends are probably written by the losers. And that's, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And I look at the legend. I mean, we're going to talk about this next. But look at like an American legend like Lost Cause revisionism. That like, oh, the United States Civil War wasn't actually fought over slavery. That somehow it was fought over.
Which is insane.
It was fought over tariffs. Hilariously, the same people who left the Union over tariffs now voted en masse for tariffs. But that's neither here nor there. but yeah, branching off of this, talking about Harriet Tubman, talking about the Underground Railroad, American mythology. I mean, it might be a newer country in the grand scheme of history, but Americanism is completely interwoven with legends and with mythology and with, you know, the you know, the myth of the frontiersman, etc. What are some American myths that you can point to that help explain, you know, where we are today?
So, obviously we've been talking about Harriet Tubman, so I feel obligated to mention her, of course. But I also feel like some of the legends that, you know, in tall tales, you remember when they used to call them that, but the tall tales of like when we were in elementary school, like what was the name of that man that wrote
Bunyan?
The Hurricane?
Paul Bunyan?
Billy, not Paul Bunyan, but yes,
Johnny
Paul Bunyan and Baby the Big Blue Ox, Johnny Appleseed. Billy the Kid, that was his name. He's the one that wrote The Tornado.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you remember? So, like, those stories are all great. John Henry, all those stories are great. But out of all those ones that I just named, it's really John Henry and his perseverance that's both tragic and beautiful at the same time, right? So, like, I feel like John Henry's story, for listeners that probably don't, you know, remember or know the story of John Henry, he worked on a train track, like hammering down like the tracks for the train, and so he had to race against this like steam powered or this engine powered like track setter. I don't even know what he like exactly did. I just know that he was hammering the fuck out of these train tracks.
Yeah, he raced the steam plow.
Yeah, that's what it was. He raced a steam plow. So and one, two, crazy as fuck. But like the fact that in this myth, this black man worked himself to death in order to prove that he a human can outbeat a machine, that's powerful stuff, man. I don't know like the exact name to call it, but it's like, whoa, that's tragic. It's sad and it's beautiful, because that I believe is the most American thing, especially black American thing, like black American myth I can think of, that is like that is a clear representation of how were treated today, not just black people, but any marginalized group. That's how we're treated today. We have to, in order for us to prove ourselves, we have to literally work ourselves to death to even have some sort of recognition. Because the story of John Henry would not have hit as hard if he hadn't died. Like at the very end, if he didn't die at the end of that, nobody would really care about the story. But because he died, and he died doing what he thought was noble, which that there needs to be stuff unpacked with that in and of itself. But the fact that he was that dedicated is a testament to like to the type of man that he is, you know.
Yeah, and the John Henry story, I think it speaks a lot to another aspect of Americanism, where we'll go halfway with the criticism. Like, no one stopped to question, like, hey, maybe this guy shouldn't have been working himself to death every day. Maybe he shouldn't have been in a position to compete against the machine for his livelihood. But everyone forgets that part. They're like, oh, isn't this so glorious that he was such a hard worker that he died doing... Did he love that? I don't know. I mean, he was good at it, but I don't know if that equates to love. But it shows, I don't want to say hypocrisy, but a halfway, they only go halfway with the John Henry story. Like, the things that killed John Henry weren't necessarily the steam plow or even his overexertion.
Right.
What killed John Henry was the society he lived in, where, you know, humans were compelled to be machines.
No, literally, and honestly, the parallels are actually sickening, because now today we have creatives going up against generative AI, which it's going to sound a little weird for me, but I believe that in some cases, like using AI for like your grammar, checking like grammar and punctuation and proofreading. I believe that's, you know, ethical. It can be ethical. However, when we get into, like, you know, the generative AI and generating, you know, like, there's a whole book that's currently about to be published that was created straight up by AI, which I feel like that's just going to be one fat ass mess, but that's neither here nor there. But it's an odd, strange parallel to see people now going through and having to compete with a machine. It's literally John Henry, but in reality. And it's kind of crazy. I haven't seen anybody die yet because of AI. I'm not saying that it hasn't happened, but, you know, I just think that it's a little weird that it is happening.
There's a lot of parallels to draw, because the same material and political and market conditions were present when John Henry was alive as they are today.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah.
Literally. And the, like, even with looking at society allowing it to happen. I mean, for example, I don't know if you've been keeping up with what's been going on in Tennessee, but they just opened up this AI out there. It has like its like facility is in I believe it's in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis, Tennessee is one of the blackest cities in the entire country, and that's a fact. The city itself relies upon the water from the Mississippi River, which, if you know, that's a very clean river. But a very clean water source. However, with generative AI, because it takes up so much water to cool this machine, and they only can use fresh water to cool it, and the water gets polluted, they dump it right back into the Mississippi River. So, of course, people are consuming this water, getting really sick, and not understanding what's going on. And it goes to show you just how dangerous, you know, that this can be. Like I said before, you know, there are certain aspects of AI that literally everybody uses every single day. I mean, if you have an iPhone, you have Siri. If you have an Android or a Motorola, you have Cortana or whoever, you know. And then, of course, like, you have your Grammarly and things like that. But when it comes down to, you know, that generative AI and the amount of pollution that it can cause, the carbon footprint that thing has is immense. It's the fattest thing on this planet. And it's just further driving us to, you know, unfortunately, our demise. And hopefully with you know, trying to segue back into writing, but hopefully with stories coming out about, you know, like, you know, the anti-environmentalism and just, you know, the pollution that this technology can cause. I think if we have more stories that parallel that or that are straight up just for talking about that, I feel like we'll start to see like a shift and a change. But it really comes down to these creatives that have that are privy to, you know, what's going on and that can, you know, expertly add it to their writing.
So you just said, you know, hopefully someday soon in the future, there will be some shift change in the zeitgeist, in the way mm-hmm. we view things like AI, in the way we view things like regulation yes. of AI and environmental and ecological protection. Mm-hmm. Do you think mm-hmm. that mythology has a role to play in creating this shift change? Do you think that there is a future for mythology at all? Yeah. And what does that look
absolutely
like,
that
future?
So, in my opinion, the mythology as a whole, although, yes, they can be very entertaining, very action-packed drama, right? But when we really boil down even older myths, even like the ancient myths, when we boil those down, a lot of them are character studies. A lot of them are, you know, societal parallels and whatnot. I find it that the stories that are coming out now, like, you know, all of our superheroes, all of our favorite franchises and whatnot, even actual individuals that are, you know, famous today, I'm speaking about like celebrities and whatnot, I feel as though they are myths in the making. And the reason why I feel that way is because I'll use a book, a book series / TV show series. Have you heard of The Wheel of Time?
I've heard of it.
Okay. So it's a book, right? Really, really, like, apparently it's really, really good. I have not read it all the way through, but from what I did read, it's actually a lot of fun. But in The Wheel of Time, there is the story takes place on a, like, pretty much like a post-apocalyptic Earth, right? There's like orcs and monsters. It's fantasy, but what similar to my story, so like there are cycles, right? So there, the story takes place, I believe, in the fourth or the fifth cycle. There are seven cycles in total. The story itself takes place during like the third, fourth, or fifth cycle, and they make references to like today's society, right? So, but they don't make reference how you would think they make references. They make references speaking as if, you know, like today's society was like very divine and ancient and like arcane, right? So in the story, there are two quote unquote gods that were battling across the seas. And these two gods were named Rus and Mer. I don't know if you've like picked up on it, but Rus is Russia and Mer is America. And the fact that, right. And the fact that they made it like that, it was like, oh, I see how we got our legends about the past. Because then there was another little, like, little legend or story within the story, within the overall plot, where two individuals, they hopped into the belly of a metal eagle, and shot up to the stars. That's a NASA astronauts going up to space. So it's like, okay, I'm starting to understand how we got to where we are now, and how like these individuals like came up with these myths and legends. So I feel like if we're able to, like, as a writer, if I'm able to, or any other writer is able to, not necessarily mimic that, but find clever ways to explain away, you know, a myth or like a god's like power or something. I think that's like super clever. One thing that comes to mind is like maybe like some years down like 2,000 years or whatever, we'll probably see like there was this god, this deity by the name of Luwain, and he could spit fire when really he was just rapping the entire time.
That's really funny, and that's an interesting way to sort of end this, because it reminds me a lot of like archaeologists today who mm-hmm. you know, dig up stuff in the past, and basically anything they dig up, they're like, this is used for ceremonial purposes, and that's like the only was the only thing people did back then, is they just did ceremonies. And
rituals and cannibalism, like
the only three things that ancient people did. They didn't do anything else. It was ritual, nothing and then else. A little bit of cannibalism just to be safe on top.
You know, maybe throwing a sacrifice here or there, but you know,
a little sacrifice. That you know, you want to make sure the sun's still burning for Tlaloc, you know.
You know, but, just saying, I kind of did not fuck with that red sun. It was weird.
But that's also important to mention too. Not all myths or legends are any good. Some of mm-hmm. them are really exactly. bad. Some of them have really led bad. To the worst things that I can think of. I mean,
like honestly,
but yeah, quite genuinely. I mean, a lot of the like. 20th century, I think, is a pretty perfect example of what myth-making and legendary figures can do to just completely screw up a timeline.
Bro, no, I'm not even gonna lie to you. I can even give you a Greek myth that is just, like, bad, bro. I would hate to be in this man's shoes. You know the word tantalizing? You know that yes. word, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm pretty sure you're aware of the myth in which the word tantalizing originates from. Honestly, I would hate to be in that position.
I am actually not aware of where the word tantalizing comes from. I thought you were going to drop some Oedipus Rex stuff. I was prepared for that. I don't know about the tantalizing myth, though.
Okay. So, tantalizing comes from the Greek name. Right, comes from the Greek name Tantalus, right? So Tantalus was an ancient Greek figure, and he also goes by Attis. So he basically had this extremely like terrible punishment, where he is in like this pit, like quicksand pit almost, like a tar pit, and he's sinking, right? He's starving at the same time, which, you know, if you're hungry, you're never in a good mood. So clearly this man is pretty pissy. So he is in this tar pit and he's sinking, and there's this branch of fruit that he can barely reach it, right? So he's trying to like stick his arm up as much as he can, but the higher he reaches his hand, the slower he sinks. And the word tantalizing comes from the desire, you know, the desire to have something, but it's just barely out of reach. You can't get it. Oh my God. Great. It is a great story. It's a great myth, but also at the same time, a very shitty myth, because why are you doing this to me? You know, so that's where the word tantalizing comes from. Another ancient Greek myth that is also it's like just desserts, but also really shitty. Narcissus, you know, the man who was obsessed with himself, and the, you know, the gods were like, well, if you're so obsessed with yourself, then you can only look at yourself. Like, look in this mirror, and that's what you got.
And then he drowns himself, right? Because he sees his own reflection in the mm-hmm. mirror. Yeah, or in the water.
Yeah,
and he jumps in after himself
in the water, and he was so enamored by his reflection that he was like, "I want you. I want me."
As we wrap up today, what's next on the docket for you? Are you going to stay with Mystics for a minute? I know you mentioned a trilogy. Are you going to continue the discourse following that trilogy, or would that be it for Mystics, or you're going to transfer to something else?
So, it's a very good question. So, I have a really big plan for Mystics. I like to call myself a tactician. So I initially planned for this story to be like a web series, and then of course it evolved into a novel series. So I wanted to write like a series of books, somewhere between like, I want to say like at least like 12 or 11 books in like the main storyline, and then like have side stories and like other branching stories and this, that, and the other. But I've since matured from that initial plan for Mystics, and instead I intend on writing three sets of trilogies, and the names of them are pretty much like the stages in which you're supposed to get the story. So the first set of trilogies is called the original prototype trilogy. So it's all three of those books are going to be titled Mystics Prototype, followed by the book of whomever is the book is about. So that's like the first set, and then the second set of books is called the Book of Mystics, and there's supposed to be obviously three books in that. That takes place and Prototype takes place in the fictional realm, except for the very last book, and then Book of Mystics takes place solely on Earth, and this is where we get into like alternate timeline, alternate history type of fiction and fantasy. And then the third trilogy that I have planned is called Mystics Go Beyond. And that basically is obviously like the post of the Book of Mystics. So that takes place like immediately after Book of Mystics, and it follows the characters as they make their way back to their the original fantasy realm that they're all from. So those are like, that's like the main series, so to speak, that I'm writing. And then of course I do intend on writing like side stories and side books to accompany the main line, one of the main stories of the three trilogies, to really like flesh out certain characters that get introduced in those books, as well as, you know, just expanding the world and lore of Mystics. So I want to say in total, so that's 9 books for the three trilogies. I intend on writing a prequel book, so that's 10. And then I want to say 6 more books that are like side stories, or that are like companion pieces, so to speak. So in total, I'm looking at around 16 books that I'm looking to write, as far as like novels go. And of course, you know, I want to have it adapted to like a manga, and then eventually the end all goal is to have an anime or a movie or something like that. But I have to like strategically plan that, you know?
Yeah, and that would be, I think that you have a pretty good shot of when it does get big, you know, getting picked up by as a TV show or something, because the one thing that people are looking for is like, you know, content that already has some sort of foundation. And you're literally, all of your work is literally based in the foundational myths of several of the most important cultures in the world. So I think that people will be very interested in seeing that take on it. And from such a unique perspective as yours, I mean, it's a huge undertaking. And I just want to wish you luck, you know, doing all this, because it's a huge endeavor. And I, for one, believe in you, and I completely support what you're doing. And I think it's going to end up becoming really, really good.
Yeah, much obliged. I really appreciate that. I did, you know, like I write these stories, I tell these stories so that I can be able to connect with, you know, with everybody as much as I can, you know, as possible. I feel like whenever anybody reads the story, they, you know, I feel like they, for some weird reason, I feel like they feel seen. I'm not sure as to why, because I've had a couple of people tell me that. They're like, you know, I feel, you know, acknowledged and seen. I feel like this is a story that, you know, I needed, because I'm not sure if you you know, listen to any of like my audio or if you read any of the story, but I have a very I like to make the environment of like where my characters are. I like to try to make it cozy, because I feel like that coziness is really what attracts people. Of course, with like the suspense and things like that. But it's when you read it and you're like imagining what's going on, it's very like homey feeling, you know, very cozy. But I'll say, like, with to, you know, to end it on that, I will say that, like, with my writing now, I have about 5.5 more chapters to finish for the Book of Minerva before I have finished its manuscript. I can confidently say that with the new mature writing style that I have, I definitely improved on that coziness factor, and it's still, you know, it's still like super suspenseful, but it's like you want to be in that suspense. You feel comfortable in that suspense, you know?
Yeah. You come for the comfort, you stay for the suspense.
Exactly. You know, you already know.
So, we're finishing up here. How do people reach you online, and was there anything that we didn't touch on that you're very passionate about that you'd like to mention here? Anything at all?
I'll start with plugging my socials. So, you can pretty much find me on TikTok and on X. On TikTok, I believe my name is, you can find me at The First Hierophant. And I believe it's also the same on Twitter as well, too.
And that's a tarot card, Twitter, right? The Hierophant?
Yes, the Hierophant. And I wanted to to actually speak on that. The I was looking for another word, because to create, I created a lot for this story. Language systems, power systems, even created a religion. And I was looking for another word for, or a synonym for, prophet or messiah, and I came across hierophant, and it my favorite word of the day, it resonated with me, and I was like, you know what, I think this is going to be, like, if we're looking for like a messiah in a story or a prophet in a story, the Hierophant is that of this story. The closest being to the patron deity of the story was just Tiamat. Her messenger, her messiah, is called the Hierophant. And the main character, Merlin, he's actually the reincarnation of the first Peter Pan. So that's why his story is so important. And anybody he's connected to, their story is also important as well.
Nice. I think I kind of stepped in the middle of your plug there. I apologize for that. I was.
No, it's fine. So my ex, so my TikTok is at the first Hierophant. My ex is at first Hierophant, so minus the. And then you can also find me on Facebook at, I believe, I have to pull it up on my phone because you know how that goes. So you can find me on Facebook at K Young, or you can type in dyslexic author K Young, I tend to post very rarely on that. And then if you were interested in reading my stories for free, you can do so on webnovel.com. The names of the stories are Mystic's Prototype, The Book of Merlin, Volume 1, Mystic's Prototype, The Book of Minerva, and Mystic's Prototype, Yasuke's Story. Those three are available now. There are about 23 chapters of The Book of Merlin available, with two more chapters coming out within like the next week or so. And then The Book of Minerva is currently being syndicated right now, and I've got about 8 chapters up of that and have chapters releasing weekly for that. So the next couple of weeks, we'll be getting into some pretty fun and exciting stuff. I'm really excited to share that with everyone. Especially my Academy arc. I've been working really hard, planning really hard for this. It's a very titular plot line for stories like this, reincarnation stories like this. So I'm really excited to release that. But you can read the story there. If you want to purchase my physical book, I have that on Amazon as well. It's called A Mystic's Threads and Tales. It's a short little anthology of 3 stories, and hopefully, you know, you enjoy that. It's a quick little read, less than 100 pages.
All right, well, Kay, I want to say thanks so much for being on the show. I really had a good time. I hope that you had a good time. I think my audience really enjoyed hearing from you. I mean, and I think this will be a completely new aspect for them, and I think they'll really appreciate it. So thank you so much, Kay.
No, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate this conversation. I also just really love talking about my story, so any excuse that I can to talk about my book, I will definitely take it.
So again, thank you to everyone who is listening. We'll be sure to include Mystics and all of your social media plugs, Kay, in the description of this episode. And just one more time, I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. Thank you so much, and I hope you all have a mystical day. And the word of today is Hierophant. Thank you.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.